Brian Lara and WNYC, and our online video picks for this week are up on our website. Every week we choose five videos from the web that we think you may be interested in, and I anchor them in a picks video. For this St. Patrick's Day week, they include a video that asks, with a name like Obama, maybe he's really Irish. See our online video picks at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lara Show. Well, it's Friday, and that does mean follow-up Friday, where we dig down deeper on things that have come up in the last week. And last Friday, during Open Phones, we got a call from David, who identified himself as a board-certified internist.
Low-dose naltrexone has stopped the progression of every autoimmune disease that it's ever touched.
Well, maybe, but this claim sparked many inquiries, both on and off the air. And so we'll follow up on that now and try to put that particular drug, naltrexone, in the larger context of a sort of underground network of medical information. In this coming Sunday's New York Times Magazine, Thomas Goetz writes about the website Patients Like Me, where people with chronic diseases compare notes on treatments and sometimes on medications that were not approved for the use on their particular diseases. And he joins us now. Thomas Goetz, thanks for coming on WNYC today. Hi there.
Hi, good to be here.
And this is a subject up your alley in a number of ways. You're a deputy editor at Wired with a master's in public health, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What do you know, first of all, about that drug naltrexone that the caller was touting and that sparked so many people with various kinds of autoimmune problems to call us up afterwards and say, what was that? What was that?
Yeah. So low dosage naltrexone has gotten a lot of people excited. It is originally approved by the FDA for drug treatment to get people off of narcotics, basically. And it's used at a high dosage, about 50 milligrams. It's at this point gone off patent, and it's used a little bit for alcoholism as well. But what's happened in the last few years is that people have found that in very low dosages, about 4 or 5 milligrams instead of 50 milligrams, what it does is it actually, instead of blocking the opiate receptors in the brain or in the immune system, the nervous system, what happens is that it tricks the immune system into thinking that it needs to produce more endorphins. And that seems to have the effect of actually really helping patients who are suffering from autoimmune diseases like ALS or multiple sclerosis.
How does it help them? Because endorphins I usually think of as the feel-good hormone, right? It gives you a runner's high or other things that make you have a sense of well-being.
Right. So I was partly afraid you were going to ask that. The immune system is one of the most complicated systems in the body. It's not very well understood, but it's part of the nervous system is tied into it. There's brain chemistry. Basically, it's the reason it works isn't even clear to researchers at this point. But as I said, what it does for in drug treatment is it inhibits the opiate receptors, which are kind of combined with endorphins, and give you that kind of high that people use mm-hmm. drugs for.
So what is the medical community from the pharmaceutical company itself, which of course would love to have any of its medications used for more and more things, to doctors treating individual patients, what do they do with anecdotal evidence like this when the patent has not been approved for the treatment of other diseases?
Well, right. So that's a very big distinction, actually. So the impression is, oh, the pharmaceutical industry always wants its drugs to be used. But when a drug falls off patent, the pharmaceutical company no longer has exclusive rights to use or to exploit that drug.
Uh-huh.
So they actually have there's very little incentive for a drug company to explore new usages for a drug after it's fallen off patent, because if they find something that the drug does, anybody has rights to go out.
Well, off patent, maybe I used the wrong phrase. Does off patent in this respect mean that it just is being used for things other than it was approved for?
No, I'm sorry. There's off-label usage. So the FDA will approve a specific drug for a specific purpose.
Right, that's really what I meant to say, was off-label.
Right, I'm sorry. So but it's actually, both things are in effect here. So off-label usages are when the FDA has approved it for X, but then physicians learn that actually it works for Y also, and so they start prescribing it for Y. And these things kind of are often informally vetted. Sometimes there are actual clinical trials that are conducted to look at off-label usages, but the FDA is pretty strict that companies, pharmaceutical companies, cannot market drugs for off-label usages.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes this kind of word-of-mouth thing in the physician and ultimately the patient communities.
So where does the website Patients Like Me come in? This is what you're going to profile in your New York Times Magazine article this weekend.
Right, right. So Patients Like Me is a very interesting website because, there are a lot of medical information websites out there. There are dozens of patient communities or online support groups. But what's different about Patients Like Me is that when you join, you're actually inputting your health information on a very granular and data-intensive level. So you're not just saying, oh, I have this symptom and it bothers me. You're actually quantifying it. You're showing how long you've had that symptom. You rank it on a scale. You enter your prescriptions, and you show how effective they are, and you chart it over time. And what that becomes is, in short, data. And so your information combines with other people's information, and the website churns it all, aggregates it, and turns it into these quite compelling charts and graphs that will tell you and tell other patients what might be effective treatments, what might be ways that you can modify your own treatment to improve your outcomes.
So in other words, one of the things that it does is to automatically graph individuals' anecdotal stories of using drugs off-label or for things other than they were approved, and give some kind of what looks like statistical representation of effectiveness.
Right, and sometimes some of the information is subjective, and some of it is objective. Dosage, length of time, those are objective measures. How well it works are subjective measures. But the important thing is that by charting it over time and putting your information together with other people's information, you're able to actually suss out some very compelling trends and information. So for something like naltrexone, there are about 100 people at Patients Like Me who are doing low-dosage naltrexone to treat their MS. And if you're considering it, you can click onto the website, see how many of them are using it and for what reasons. So some are using it to slow their disease progress. Some are using it to control specific symptoms. You can see what dosages they're at, and then you can see ultimately whether they think it works or not. And the other patients basically just fill out these surveys, and then it gets turned into data. So it becomes a very effective way of taking this anecdotal word-of-mouth information and actually seeing in stark numbers kind of whether patients in real time are finding those off-label usages effective.
Listeners, we can take phone calls for Thomas Goetz about his upcoming New York Times Magazine article this Sunday, getting a little preview of that piece and the website that he writes about, Patients Like Me, and the issues surrounding it, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. To what you just said, the users of the website really have to trust the information that others put up there, and it's a different leap of trust. I mean, you have to trust your doctor, too, and sometimes you don't, and you have to trust the pharmaceutical companies, too, and sometimes you don't, but it's a different kind of trust because you don't really know who these people are.
Right, absolutely, and there is that leap of faith, but what's compelling, again, about when you're aggregating data, so they have, right now, they have between 7,000 and 8,000 patients contributing their information. And when you get into those numbers and when you start getting 10, 20, 30,000 patients on there, one person who might be a ne'er-do-well and wants to kind of take their time for some reason and try to game the system, one person's data isn't really going to change things. So you have a kind of statistical purity that works. You know, you get your typical bell curve. And if there are outliers of people who are untrustworthy and the majority nonetheless are trustworthy, you're still getting good information.
Let's take some calls. Our phones are booming. Mike in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, am I on?
Yes.
I heard the piece last week, and I was intrigued by it because I have a relative that has Parkinson's, and I am a technical person, a researcher. I went to the internet, and it took all of about 5 minutes to see that there have been at least a dozen, albeit small but professionally run, controlled studies using low dosages of naltrexone as an opiate inhibitor to reverse the symptoms of autoimmune diseases. And they all have come back absolutely zero. And they were controlled for placebo effects. I know that,
you know, zero meaning no effect?
No effect whatsoever. And I know that people want to see and, you know, want to believe in some sort of a conspiracy and that there is some off-label use, which is miraculous. But it didn't take long on the Internet just to find that there are studies that have been done, and they've just come back empty. And I'd be curious to see what this fellow has to say. Anyway, thank you, and you can duplicate what I did. It took 10 or 15 minutes at most.
Mike, thank you very much. And Thomas Goetz?
Well, so I certainly haven't gone through all the research studies one by one. There have been a handful of studies that have been conducted, usually by universities around the country, about low-dosage naltrexone. Often what happens, though, because going back to the off-patent thing, because there's not one pharmaceutical company that stands to benefit from a new approved indication from the FDA, these studies often lack the statistical power that the FDA would require in order to approve it for these low-dosage autoimmune treatments. So basically, I understand if the caller went and found that the evidence was unconvincing, but the issue is whether or not naltrexone is effective or not. I have no horse in the race. But it's a matter of how good are the studies and how statistically rigorous are they, and is there somebody out there who's willing to put the money behind to find out?
John in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. How are you,
Brian? Okay.
I just want to introduce another idea. My dermatologist 5 years ago recommended to me a very strange drug use of something called cyclosporin, which is typically used to treat the likelihood of an organ transplant reject by slightly reducing the response of parts of the immune system. I had really, really severe eczema for about 10 years that two or three different dermatologists could not control by any other method. So one of them recommended me to him, and he said he had been using it with his patients for a long time. I started it. It works extremely well, and what's particularly useful about it is you can range from a very low doses of 50 milligrams a day all the way up to a much higher doses of 300 or 400 milligrams a day, depending on the season and how bad the eczema is, because, of course, that changes with seasons. The moisture in the air is a big factor. So it's
another example of using a medication effectively, in your experience, for something other than it was developed for.
Absolutely. Something very different, as a matter of fact. The example that you were talking about, it seems to me, are very closely related. These two are really quite distantly related, and yet it's very effective. And in this case, I didn't get it from the Internet. A dermatologist who had used it in his practice was able to recommend mm-hmm. it.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much for the story. It's kind of curious, Tom, you know, if a drug is developed for something as different from eczema as organ transplants, what gives somebody the idea to, I'll try that on my eczema?
Yeah, it is funny how the off-label kind of indications can be completely, on a different spectrum than the ones that are approved. But you have to remember that pharmaceuticals are pretty blunt instruments. You know, they're messing with our body chemistry in ways that we aren't ever absolutely sure what's going on. And so what a pharmaceutical company does is they have a new molecular compound. They think it has certain attributes that are going to make it work one way. It could work in dozens mm-hmm. of different ways.
Right.
But they pursue a certain course, and they look at their studies and see what it has, what have the most effect.
Right, and so that, of course, could be damaging side effects, or it could be, well, gee, my body didn't reject the new liver, and by the way, my face cleared up.
Right, exactly.
So, Janet in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I'm very interested in this. I'd like to know whether this is an entirely drug-oriented site or whether someone who has been freed of multiple sclerosis or manic depression by eidetic imaging would have a chance to record that information. That's a non-pharmacological
mm-hmm. right.
Approach.
Practice on the Patients Like Me website, Tom.
Right, of course. So the communities are absolutely not geared around pharmaceuticals. It's for people treating their disease in all sorts of ways.
So that would include alternative medicine and everything.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And those are all, I mean, that's the kind of power of the tool. It can harness information and data from any source.
Has the site been responsible for any breakthroughs?
So it's interesting. Right now there is a kind of ad hoc experiment going on among users in the ALS community who caught wind of an off-label usage of lithium used as a treatment for ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. So there was a study in Italy going on. Word filtered onto the Patients Like Me website, and they started, 15, 20, 30. Then now they're up to 100 patients with ALS using lithium, and they're really making use of the data tracking tools on the website. And it's right now it's only been going on for a couple of months, but it's the kind of thing where you get kind of real time feedback on clinical trials that otherwise take 2, 3, 4 years to conduct and ultimately publish.
Let's get one more call in here. Zoe in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Zoe.
Hi. For several years, I've been using something called Trazodone for insomnia. It was originally developed as an antidepressant, but made people very sleepy, so it wasn't useful, but it works just fine to
make you sleepy. Okay, so there's another one. We just have 30 seconds left. How was this website founded?
It was founded by a family of two brothers whose other brother had ALS, and they found that they had a huge amount of information on their brother, just data because they were following his case so closely. And they realized that it would be an effective tool not just for their brother and the ALS community, but for people with all sorts of diseases.
And we should mention that the website also makes its money by sharing the information with drug companies. Does that do anything to the reliability of the information in 10 seconds?
Well, it's interesting. The integrity of the information is only as good as the patients. So the company really has no incentive to adulterate that information for the benefit of pharmacists.
You can read more about this website, Patients Like Me, and Thomas Goetz's article in the Sunday New York Times Magazine. Thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Sure. Thanks for being here.
And have a great weekend, everyone. Happy Easter. If you celebrate Easter, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.